For those of you who came in late, I am not Joseph, and I'm not going to try to present his talk. He was in a car accident a few months ago, and he's doing okay now, but he was unable to come. So I am stepping in and giving a talk about both rice crop management and breeding strategies that International Rice Research Institute is putting into place right now. So I'm a soil scientist. I'm going to talk about a number of things that are not soil science. So I'm in each of the slides, I've cited my colleagues who are involved. So since I'm the first one in this symposium, I thought I would throw out some definitions of food security. So 1976, it was defined as the availability at all times of adequate world food supplies of basic foodstuffs. That has been modified a number of times. A 2001 expansion of that is that food security means to ensure that all people at all times have physical, social, and economic access to sufficient, safe, and nutritious food to meet their dietary needs and food preferences for an active, healthy life. So the implications of this change are that food security, initially in 1976, this was apparently the first somewhat agreed upon definition of the term. Initially, it was mostly about supply. Since then, it has come to mean many different things, including many aspects that are outside the scope of agricultural research. So rice is important to food security. 90% of the world's rice is produced and consumed in Asia, and 65% of the world's poor live in Asia. So as Dr. Dorado was just saying, the percentage of poverty is higher in Africa, but because Asia is so much more populated, the absolute numbers of poor are higher in Asia. And in Asia, almost everyone eats rice 2 or 3 times a day. So Erie usually classifies rice systems very broadly into rain-fed or irrigated, which unfavorable are the rain-fed systems and irrigated are the favorable ones. So the rain-fed areas are important to the food security issue because they tend to coincide very closely with the areas of poverty, of rural poverty especially, within Asia. But the irrigated areas are also quite important for food security because although they're only 50% of the total area in rice production, they produce 75% of the total amount of rice. Because they're more favorable environments, you can get much higher yields there. So to improve food security, we have two different strategies. One is that rural producers need increased income. So these are primarily in rain-fed areas. We need to improve agricultural technology there. And urban poor or other landless poor consumers need access to cheap rice. So that is the reason why we focus on increasing production in irrigated systems as well. So now I'll go ahead and define climate change very simply. The cause is anthropogenic acceleration of greenhouse gas emissions, which include methane, carbon dioxide, nitrous oxide. And it has so far, this last data here is from 2007, but when you calculate it all out in terms of carbon dioxide equivalents, the emissions are exceeding even the highest model of the International Panel on Climate Change, their scenarios. And the effect of climate change, of these greenhouse gases, is that the global average temperature is increasing. And as predicted by the models, because we're at the high end of CO2, we're also tracking at the high end of the temperature projections. So there are many uncertainties in global climate change projections, but there are two universal trends predicted by all of the models. That's that temperatures will increase. For rice production, that indicates more heat stress and rising sea levels. And that there will be more frequent and severe climate extremes. So rice is important to climate change because rice production contributes to greenhouse gas emissions and because climate change threatens rice productivity. So the first part of Erie's response in terms of how we set our research agenda is to mitigate rice cropping systems' effect on climate change, to minimize essentially the carbon footprint of rice production. So methane and nitrous oxide are directly emitted from rice fields. I'll explain that more in a moment. And so we're trying to design management systems basically to minimize the amount of those gases that are emitted. In terms of carbon dioxide, the plants take in carbon dioxide and then as they decompose, they emit carbon dioxide again. So the plant growth tends usually not to be a net sequestration of carbon in the case of rice systems. So the main carbon dioxide issues there are the energy inputs required for producing rice in terms of fertilizers and tillage, and also the energy required for cooking rice. So those are the things that Erie is aiming to minimize. Here's an explanation of how methane is emitted directly from rice fields. Any organic matter that is left on the surface or incorporated into the soil decomposes, and if the soil is flooded, it's decomposed primarily by anaerobic bacteria. And the end product of anaerobic decomposition is methane rather than carbon dioxide. There is still a significant amount of this carbon that ends up as carbon dioxide, but there is a lot that also ends up as methane, and it can either diffuse out of the soil, or most of what's released from a rice field actually comes up through the chimney of the rice plant. So it's emitted directly from the leaves. So this is an estimate of how much rice growth contributes to methane globally. As a percentage, paddy rice as a percentage of the anthropogenic methane is estimated between 12 and 26%, and as a percentage of all sources of methane, between 9 and 19%. So there's significant scope to try to improve that. One of the management methods that Erie has been studying and promoting is water-saving irrigation. And there are a variety of ways to do this. It's basically managing the field in any way that's less flooded than the typical continuously flooded practice. This one that I've highlighted here is known as alternate wetting and drying, or AWD. And the idea behind that is it's still, everything else about the system is still done the same way, the same puddling of the soil and usually the same transplanting. But when they irrigate, instead of irrigating it to keep it continuously flooded, the farmers allow the soil to go down to about 15 or 20 centimeters beneath the surface of the soil, and then they flood it again at that time rather than irrigating. So practically it means that they irrigate maybe once a week rather than every 2 days. So it has been shown to save some water. And this idea has been around for a long time, but what has made it become much more popular in recent years is actually the use of this PVC pipe. Because prior to that, scientists could tell you that, yes, it's safe to dry your paddy out to a certain moisture content, but that depends on the soil texture. It's hard to predict. The farmer doesn't know when to re-irrigate. And so if the farmer guessed wrong because the scientist told him wrong, then he would lose yield. So, but when they developed this very simple PVC pipe system where the soil has been dug out from the inside, and you can see essentially the water table, then regardless of the soil type, if the water gets down to about 15 or 20 centimeters, that's the time to re-irrigate. That's still much above field capacity. So there's still plenty of water for the rice plants. So then the question is, what effect does this, and this was originally developed in terms of saving water, what effect does this have on methane and nitrous oxide emission? So one of my Japanese colleagues, Yas Hosen, studied this on the Erie farm from 2006 to 2010 using automated gas collection systems that were running 24 hours a day, essentially, for the whole year, through both cropping seasons and the fallow. And some of his results are that the cumulative methane emission did, as expected, decrease when changing to alternate wetting and drying. But then what happens to nitrous oxide? So the process in nitrous oxide is somewhat similar to methane because it has to do with the redox potential. But the nitrous oxide tends to be formed when there's a nitrogen source and when the soil is at an intermediate redox potential. And the end process of denitrification is just N2, which is harmless, of course. But one of the intermediate products is nitrous oxide. And there has been, typically rice fields have not been considered a big source of nitrous oxide because if they're flooded continuously, then there's very little opportunity for denitrification to happen in large quantities. But if we're moving towards drier management systems, then the opportunity increases. So this, there's no data yet for the rice field contribution specifically, but agricultural land can account for about 42% of the anthropogenic sources of nitrous oxide globally. And from all sources, it's about 16%. So what did Jaas Hosen's experiment say about nitrous oxide? That in some cases, the alternate wetting and drying does indeed, as predicted, make nitrous oxide emission worse. So what can be done about that? His group did a greenhouse experiment to show that if you time the fertilizer application relative to the water application, it improves the situation. So the idea here is that in the first option for alternate wetting and drying, this represents flooding and letting the water table go down and then re-irrigation. If you apply the nitrogen here and then wait 48 hours before re-irrigating, that is the worst case scenario for nitrous oxide emission. If you wait and apply the nitrogen at the time of re-irrigation, you dramatically reduce the amount of nitrous oxide emitted. And if you keep the soil flooded for 1 week after nitrogen application, it's the best case scenario. So this was tested in the greenhouse. It was also tested in the field in the later years of the experiment. I have not yet seen the data for the later years of the experiment, so I don't know how it worked in the field yet. So that brings us to the dilemma of nitrogen fertilization. We certainly can't live without it. 40% of the world's population is alive because of nitrogen from commercial fertilizer. But about 50% of commercial fertilizers end up being released into the environment as reactive N, which is essentially anything but N2, but nitrogen gas. There's also, of course, an inherent energy cost and carbon footprint involved in manufacturing and applying nitrogen. So one mitigation option there is to use fertilizer more efficiently. And so my colleague Roland Burrish has been working a lot on a decision management tool for farmers and extension workers to use called Nutrient Manager for Rice. The idea is that it helps the farmer develop what a reasonable yield goal for their specific season in that specific location. So it's site-specific and season-specific. And this is being widely used across Asia now. And they can usually get 10 to 20% more yield, which usually involves less application of fertilizer, and then decreases the nitrous oxide emission problem. So this is from my colleague Melissa Fitzgerald in the Grain Quality Lab. This is related to minimizing the carbon footprint associated with cooking rice and eating it. The rice grain is composed of starch, protein, and lipids, and the cooking time of rice is determined by the temperature at which the crystalline structures of the starch begin to melt. So if we can identify genotypes that have crystalline structures that melt at lower temperatures, even if we could decrease the amount of cooking time by 4 minutes, the estimation is that would save 10,000 years of cooking time across Asia every day. So they are able to identify. So far, breeders don't usually breed for this, but the grain quality people are able to identify that and give that as a recommendation late in the breeding stage. So the second type of response ERIE has is adaptation, adaptive research to the changing climate. So the two main effects that I discussed earlier are the increase in temperature and the more frequent severe climate extremes. So increased temperature by itself is a threat to rice production, and it doesn't have to be a very high temperature. If you get above 38 degrees during the time of flowering, during the pollination time, For most genotypes, you get a significant yield reduction. The pollens don't form very well and they don't set. So there are two strategies that the breeders are working on at Erie. One is escape the heat by identifying genotypes that flower earlier in the day, so they escape the hottest, most intense part of the day. And so they screened more than 4,000 of them, found a few that did actually flower earlier in the day, but they ended up finding the most effective trait actually in Oryza officinalis rather than Oryza sativa. And they, with that trait, they can advance the time of day of flowering by 2.5 hours. From the typical time is between 11 and 1. So then the second part of managing heat stress is developing genotypes that tolerate the heat. So this is an example of a susceptible genotype that here are the pollen grains and the pollen tubes under normal conditions, and under heat stress conditions that simply doesn't form pollen grains. Whereas here is a tolerant type that they found that does still form pollen grains under heat-stressed conditions. Okay, so moving on to the next thing that needs to be adapted to, which is salinity. Because if the temperatures increase globally, the sea levels will rise. And the most productive parts of Asia are in the mega river deltas, which are identified on this map. So as the sea levels rise, these mega river deltas are already at quite low elevation. So you get a lot of saltwater intrusion and increased salinity problems, and of course also just a generally decreased rice production area. So there's another group at Erie who's working on breeding for salinity stress, including identifying the tolerance mechanisms and looking for markers and genes. So right now, the popular varieties can be introgressed with a Saltol gene that converts them into salt-tolerant versions, and that takes about 2 to 3 years per variety. Two varieties have already been completed in Bangladesh and are now being grown by farmers. And IR64, which is another popular mega variety, should be ready early next year. There's another group at Erie working on drought tolerance, both the breeding and the physiological mechanisms. So they're trying to screen the genotypes across multiple sites, especially in South Asia, and they're looking for genotypes that have high yields both during drought and non-drought conditions. The screening there is a little bit tricky because you can't actually screen both of those at the same site. You can't control that experiment very well. There are some places where they've tried to make rain-out shelters, but at Erie headquarters in the Philippines, for example, it rains too much. We have a hard time screening for drought there. Another possible climate-related threat is submergence for periods of the season, of the rice cropping season. And so this has already been quite successful. One of the plant breeding groups at Erie identified a gene that enables the plant to survive submergence for about 2 weeks if the submergence happens in the vegetative growth period. So far, no one's made much progress if the submergent happens during the reproductive phase. But at least if early in the season the crop is submerged for up to 2 weeks, this gene it basically helps arrest its growth so that it doesn't use up all its energy to get long and spindly and then flop over and die eventually. So what you can see here is sub 1 has already been introgressed into many popular varieties and has already been used in farmers' fields. And so this is just an experimental plotted area that was submerged for 17 days. And you can see that the varieties that do not have sub 1 in them, almost complete mortality, and the varieties that do have sub 1 really did very well. So it's the same varieties with the new gene. With all of these genotype selection work for all of the different stresses, we always work with participatory varietal selection, which means that we're testing the genotypes on a very large scale over multiple locations, and that we are always involving farmers to be the ones to help select the varieties adapted to the local conditions. So then a question from this is, from these two, both mitigation and adaptation research lines of research that Erie is doing, what is the potential impact? He's been undergoing exercises with one of our impact specialists, David Raitzer, to estimate what the likely impact is. And so, for example, with adoption of water-saving irrigation techniques to mitigate methane emission, it's estimated that AWD will decrease methane emissions about 50%, but they may be partially offset by increased nitrous oxide emission. So the net global warming potential mitigation would be about a 20% decrease. If you go to an example of the adaptation efforts, for each of the stress tolerance traits, like salinity tolerance or heat tolerance, it's expected to increase the grain yield by 1 to 2 tons per hectare, which, in cases of severe stress, is sometimes a doubling of the yield. And it's possible to have multiple traits increase the yield additively. For example, if you have an area that is affected both by flooding and by ocean water, then you'd have submergence and salinity tolerance. So if we come back to our original slide about definitions of food security, I've highlighted here the concept of availability at all times and ensuring that all people at all times have access to food. So the availability at all times has more to do with the supply side and with Erie's research to try to increase production in most favorable environments. And the all people at all times has more to do with the farmers themselves, especially in the rural, less favorable production areas. But the other thing to notice about this is that there's a whole lot here in this definition that Erie's research has nothing to say about yet. There are some people at Erie, and I haven't presented this, but doing research on the economic aspects of it and the policy implications for that. But it's important, I think, and as we discuss this throughout this symposium, to remember that food security is a political issue and that we need to help provide the agricultural science behind it, but that by itself is not enough to ensure food security. So, and here is a list of my colleagues whose data I have just presented to you.
Do we have some time here for questions?
Yes. When you grow rice with puddled soils, it uses a lot of water. Mm-hmm. So, can you tell us a little bit about what Deary is doing about growing rice without puddling direct seeded rice? And we just heard this morning about in southern Brazil where we got a substantial 2-ton increase in yield in farmers' fields in just 2 years, in 5 years, through direct seeding. No-till, herbicide-resistant rice.
Yes. Sure, I'll repeat the question, and that is, what is Erie currently doing with non-puddled systems, which usually involves direct seeding rather than transplanting? And there is, I didn't cover that in the scope of this presentation, but there is a significant effort going on at Erie to do that, and basically also to do various types of reduced tillage or conservation tillage, and I think Pat Wall will be talking more about that later. Part of what Erie is doing is, in addition to studying the tillage aspects, they're also one of the major problems. If you don't puddle rice, then becomes weeds. The weeds change significantly. And so they've been working on various strategies for weed management in direct seeded rice. Direct seeded rice is quite popular in some parts of Asia, especially where there's a labor shortage during the transplanting season. Yes, this graph, the details are actually in the map that I showed. Let me see if I can go back to it. Down here, you can see the elevation. So the red is 0 to 1 meters above, the dark red is 0 to 1 meters above sea level, and the blue is actually below sea level. But I don't know the actual percentage of it, because it's not primarily my field of expertise, but what the problem here is that these river deltas are actually the most productive and fertile places for rice growth in all of Asia. It's usually, historically, the long-term trends are that any country that has a river delta is a net rice exporter, and any country that does not is a net rice importer. And so, and all of the river deltas essentially are in this red zone of being very low elevation. So it's a big concern.
One more question. The one issue of climate change, of course, that you didn't address was rising levels of atmospheric carbon dioxide and the stimulation of growth and the interactions with all those other things.
Right.
What theory are you doing about understanding that process?
There are a couple of different things that Erie is doing on that. One, it is true, what I didn't mention, there are a few places in which the changing climate will actually improve rice production. And part of that is in just because of temperature increase in the northern parts of Asia, they're expected to get more rice production. But then also there's the CO2 enriched atmosphere, which could improve rice production. Right now, there's no one in Erie that's working with CO2-enriched systems, but one of the things that they're trying, the basic research that they're trying to do that addresses that kind of indirectly is in the C4 project, which is they're studying sorghum and trying to understand the mechanisms by which sorghum can actually have a C4 photosynthesis rather than C3, and then apply those to rice. So that's a short answer. Basically, there's not direct CO2 enrichment work going on in Erie right now.
Thank you very much.